recent research into the way organisms adapt to their environments has yielded some surprises. A set of immortal genes in the DNA of nearly every creature, from bacteria to whales. So-called fossil genes, bits of DNA text that were once intact and used by ancestors, but that have fallen into disuse and decay. The proof through DNA that evolution can and does repeat itself so that similar or identical adaptations have occurred in the same way in species as different as butterflies and humans. With us to describe some of these discoveries and explain how they might affect us humans is Sean Carroll. He is an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and professor of genetics at the UW-Madison, and is also the author of Endless Forms Most Beautiful and The Making of the Fittest, DNA and the Ultimate Forensic Record of Evolution.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thanks for having me.
Your title refers to the phrase forensic, and you actually begin your book, The Making of the Fittest, with a reference to crime and the way that we use DNA so repeatedly these days to exonerate the innocent. You want to talk about that and why you begin a book about evolution with a discussion of crime?
Well, DNA has worked its way into so many uses in everyday life and in forensics, in paternity testing, in genetic testing, whether that's for birth defects or for cancer typing. This is now widespread, and all of us call upon the power of DNA to increase our certainty with respect to convicting suspects or exonerating them, with knowing something about our genetic risks. And so here it is, one of the most relied upon sciences in everyday life, but it's neglected in what I refer to as sort of the philosophical realm. DNA is an incredibly rich document of history. And what I mean by that is it tells us so much about how we and other species have come to be, about our relationships on the planet. But all that information is somewhat neglected when we come around to the public's perception of the science of evolution and probably the lack of realization that so much of the science that goes into our everyday use of DNA is the exact same science that has revealed so much of the evolutionary process.
Yeah, I think you say that 100% of the public will buy the DNA evidence for crime or paternity, but it's only about 50%, you say, for evolution?
50% at best. It depends on the poll that you look at. But yeah, I think, you know, juries are certainly embracing the use of DNA. The FBI has embraced the use of DNA. The courts rely on DNA to a great degree now. CSI, I think, is in all its progeny are some of the most popular TV shows. But somewhere around half to less than half of the U.S. public accepts evolution as an explanation of life's diversity.
Well, there is evolution that's more or less visible during the course of a lifetime or two, though, isn't there, in the terms of a way a species adapts to its environment?
Well, I mean, species adapt on different timescales. And for very rapidly reproducing species like microorganisms, it's very easy to observe evolutionary change. For slowly reproducing organisms like elephants and humans, it's much harder. And that's part of, I think, the lack of acceptance of evolution has to do with the time scale that humans observe things. And I think time is one of the things that we humans struggle with. It's an enormous concept. It's very difficult for scientists, I think, to get their heads around what the meaning is of 1,000 years or 10,000 years or 1,000,000 years. We can start throwing those numbers around very easily. But, you know, 1,000,000 years is a vast amount of time. I mean, We could spend our whole hour thinking about time and not get very far. So evolution works, especially the sort of evolution that's most spectacular, you know, dinosaurs and humans and butterflies and snakes, on a long time scale. And because it's not so directly observable at that level of large creatures, that's just one other way out for sort of escaping the truth that evolution has been working on this planet for at least 3 billion years.
One of the things that you mentioned that stood out for me as a way of illustrating how much things have changed, though, over just the last maybe 25 years or so, is you say that the amount we used to know about the DNA code and genes would be about the size of this book if you put the text together, and that now the amount we know would be like two Sears towers put together.
Yeah, so it's just a way to picture how much our knowledge of the DNA record of life has changed. So DNA has a very simple alphabet, just four letters, A, C, G, and T. And if you were to type them out, all the letters that we had deciphered as scientists by the early 1980s would fit in one book. Now, if you were to type it out and put it into books and stack those books, it would be more than double the height of the Sears Tower and is growing at least 30 stories a year. I think actually the rate's picked up some even in the last year. So I'm even underestimating my own analogy there. In the last 5 or 6 years, the pace of growth of our knowledge of the DNA record has been mind-boggling. It actually overwhelms the biology community. It's like drinking out of a fire hose. None of us can keep up with it. We now have the DNA records of about 800 species. Many of those records have barely been touched yet by scientists in terms of mining them for clues about the history of life and about how species have evolved. So these are great days to be an evolutionary biologist.
I gather that it would also give you a great deal of information about the environment at the times those various DNA combinations or expressions were successful.
There's a lot of information in DNA, a lot of information about how every individual is put together, a lot of information about those species' ancestors, a lot of information about the relationships of that species to other species on the planet. And there's information in there that tells us about how they're different from other species. Every change in traits, whether that's a change in body color, a change in digestive metabolism, et cetera, all these are due to changes in DNA that then change the properties of a particular trait. And so what biologists are doing is they're pinpointing the very changes in DNA that are responsible for the differences among species and tracking how those have arisen and changed.
Now, if you go back to the, I'll call it the primordial worm. I believe there is some mention of a worm that has various traits that are found in all species now. DNA simpler, or how does that whole process work?
Well, DNA is sort of our telescope to look back through time. We also have the fossil record, but even the DNA record can tell us some things that the fossil record can't. And so our telescope can go back various depths of time. If we go back about 600 million years, we can think about the last common ancestor of most animals, which would be the worm-like creature you're thinking about. We imagine certainly of bilateral animals, so the animals that we most commonly think about today, whether that's earthworms and butterflies and zebras and humans and other animals that have bilateral symmetry. That animal, as I said, lived about 600 million years ago. And because of all the genes that are present in its descendants, we can reconstruct a picture of the genome, genome meaning the collection of all the DNA of that organism. We can reconstruct a picture of that genome, and that's still a pretty sophisticated picture. That animal was pretty well equipped in terms of the tools for building bodies and body parts and tissue types and cell types and things like that. And that the legacy of that animal exists in all the animals that we enjoy today. So that first picture tells us that simple in our minds does not necessarily mean genetically simple, and that a lot of diversity has come about by not so much inventing new genes, but changing the way old sets of genes work.
Is that how you get a wing or a foot out of a worm?
That's right. So we have a really excellent body of evidence, and this is highlighted in greater depth in my first book, Endless Forms Most Beautiful, about how a really common toolkit of bodybuilding genes can be used in myriad ways to construct most of the diversity of the animal kingdom. But we can peer deeper than that ancient worm-like creature, probably to somewhere around 3 billion years ago. And we're looking now thinking about the ancestor of all cellular life that exists on the planet. And the way we can look into that genome is by, again, looking at the genomes of all the species on the planet. That would include bacteria, fungi, organisms called archaea, which are prominent species in things like the hot springs of Yellowstone. And we see that there are several hundred genes that exist in every domain of life, whether you're animal, plant, fungus, bacterium. And those genes must have been present from early cellular life onwards, and they have remained unchanged. If you think of DNA as a text and sort of every gene as a paragraph in that text, some of those paragraphs have remained virtually unchanged for 3 billion years.
They must have developed somehow, though, even in that most primordial of forms. Well, it must have been something simpler than that key set that seems to be with us still.
Well, while our telescope goes back to key points, still going further back in time is yet another challenge. So what you're picking up on there is that while from a certain point onward there is a certain degree of complexity, of course we would like to know what existed before then. And that's when our telescope gets a little cloudy. The origin of life, the origin of cellular life, is a very difficult question to crunch. And it may well be that most of the physical traces of those events are gone. What we do know is, given early cellular complex life, that from that point on, we're pretty good at explaining how the diversity of life has unfolded since then.
It must be amazing to picture what Charles Darwin would think of all the new evidence. You know, I know you start your first chapter with a quote from Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species from 1859. He writes, "When we no longer look at an organic being as a savage looks at a ship, as at something wholly beyond his comprehension, when we regard every production of nature as one which has had a history," he goes on, "how far more interesting, I speak from experience, will the study of natural history become?" Well, how much farther would his interest go now with all this molecular biology?
I think it's safe to say we could blow his mind. we are no longer savages staring at passing ships. The title of the book, The Making of the Fittest, is really meant to express that idea that now we understand how those works have been put together, the making of all sorts of creatures. And I think Darwin, whose knowledge of natural history was immense, and there have probably been very few people to ever walk the planet who held in their minds as much firsthand knowledge as Darwin had, he would be absolutely thrilled in how we could now talk about the evolution of something like the eye, which he spent tremendous amounts of time on in The Origin of Species, because to the Victorian audience he was writing for, I mean, the eye seemed to be a work of miracles, and not something so easily explained by this process Darwin was explaining of sort of random variation and then the winnowing process of natural selection. Well, now we see much more deeply into the making of the eye. We understand how complexity is put together. We understand the building blocks, both the cellular building blocks and the genetic building blocks of making eyes. And I think if Darwin was sitting here, that's the first story I'd start with. I'd say, you know, "Mr. Darwin, let's talk about the making of an eye." And I'd show him pictures from developmental biology of how various types of eyes are put together. And then I'd tell him about the genes that are the same between squids and fruit flies and mice and humans and flatworms that build all those eyes of the animal kingdom. And then I'd just wait a little while and let that sink in.
For his eyes to widen.
That's right. Can you say something about the example that you open your book with and then also come back to at the end, and that's the bloodless fish?
This is, I think, the most amazing animal I've come across yet in the animal kingdom. So this was a fish that was discovered, first noted by zoologists in the 1920s. These were Norwegian biologists who were accompanying whaling expeditions or research expeditions to the whaling grounds of the Southern Ocean off Antarctica. And the fish startled naturalists because when they brought it up in nets just by accident and filleted it, its blood was completely colorless. And the pursuit of that mystery of the colorless blood took a couple of decades, but it was then revealed that these fish have no red blood cells. Now, this was completely at odds with everything zoologists had learned about vertebrates. So animals with backbones on this planet, they all have red blood cells, according to the textbooks, but not these fish. And they're vertebrates, for sure, these fish. And what's happened is that these fish have abandoned the making of red blood cells because they live in very, very cold water, water that's below the freezing temperature of fresh water. Now, this is seawater, so it doesn't freeze all the way. But as you know, there's sea ice in the Antarctica, and that's an important part of the ecosystem down there. Well, as that water's so cold, a high concentration of red blood cells would make their blood very viscous. Well, that's a problem. So this fish has incredibly dilute blood. If you were to compact our blood, take a sample of blood and find out how much of that was cellular material and how much was liquid, we'd be about half cells when you pack down our blood. This fish is about 1% cellular, and it's all white cells, no red blood cells.
Must have great immune systems then.
Well, they have good immune systems. Of course, not a lot of pathogens can do so well living in the cold water either. But they have very dilute blood, the easier to pump throughout their bodies, and they just passively take in oxygen through their scaleless skin. They have very enlarged capillaries and they have enlarged hearts, and so they pump a very large volume of blood through their system, but this blood contains no higher concentration of oxygen than the surrounding seawater. So this is a very, very extreme adaptation to an extreme environment. Now, what's neat about these fish is 40 or 50 years after their discovery as bloodless fish, we could look at their DNA record. And in that DNA record is an exquisite record of all sorts of adaptations these fish have undergone in adapting to the cold water. And if you look at genes, the counterpart of the genes that nourish red-blooded fish, you see that those genes are either missing or they're just a remnant of the former cells, what I refer to as a fossil gene. It's a piece of text that's in the DNA. It's recognizable, but it's full of mistakes that have accumulated over the years. So it's no longer functional. It's just really as same way a fossil weathers out of a rocky ledge. It's beat up. It's recognizable, but it's still decaying over time. There's all sorts of other adaptations that we can see in this fish's DNA. Perhaps the most other remarkable one is it's invented its own antifreeze. This fish in that cold water, if it was to contact the sea ice and it had no other preventative measure, it would be a fish stick. I mean, it would just adhere to the to the ice. But it has these very peculiar proteins in its bloodstream and tissues that prevent ice crystals from forming. It drops the freezing temperature of water. So again, in the DNA record, we can see the adaptations this fish has taken and what makes it different from its red-blooded relatives that even swim in the same waters.
Well, I like the way you used your Wisconsin background to use that antifreeze metaphor.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, not to mention the viscosity of the oil you would use in the winter versus the summer.
Absolutely. So that this fish and remember, the fish, though, has had to make all these changes while keeping the engine running. It doesn't get to stop and throw out these parts and then...
What's the time period we're talking about for these adaptations?
Well, they took place over an extended geologic period, and we can reconstruct that by looking at all sorts of relatives of these fish. There's actually a group of about 15 species that are these so-called bloodless ice fish. But they have red-blooded relatives, and that antifreeze adaptation is present in some of its red-blooded relatives. And that tells us that the antifreeze was an early adaptation. The loss of the red blood cells was a late step. And the loss of the genes for making the key protein that carries oxygen, so-called globin genes, that was a very late step in the process. Now, we understand something about geologic history that helps us understand why these fish were adapting. 33, 34 million years ago is when Antarctica was severed from South America, and that changed the ocean currents around the Antarctic. The so-called Drake's Passage, which is what we recognize between South America and Antarctica today, did not exist 35 million years ago. Well, with that, those geologic events, the currents changed and the waters around the Antarctic became more isolated and much colder. So probably in the course of 40 to 50 million years, they've dropped from maybe 55 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit now down to just under 30 degrees Fahrenheit near the continent. So there's been dramatic changes in temperature. So a lot of fish living in those regions have gone extinct. And the ice fish are a really peculiar flock of species that have made the Antarctic their home.
And it's still, though, to a great extent, isn't it just a matter of trial and error? And in other words, there might be all kinds of mutations that maybe made the fish more suitable for warmer water
right.
or something else that just didn't work here, and it was a matter of just natural selection. Is that what we're talking
That's
about?
That's what you're talking about. And I just to pick up on that a little bit, let's talk about natural selection maybe in the reverse, not as trial and error, but really error and trial. The error is that random genetic events happen, mistakes happen in the copying of DNA every day. Every new individual is born with a new set of mutations that didn't exist in its parents. And those random errors create variation, and that variation creates little performance differences in every individual, whether they're a little less tolerant or more tolerant of certain temperatures, all sorts of aspects of their physiology. And in the process of natural selection, what we mean by that is a competitive process. That is that individuals, some are going to perform a little better than others, and those that perform a little better are either going to survive longer and or produce more offspring. And as that process is compounded generation after generation, it really adds up such that the descendants of better performing individuals become more prevalent, and essentially the population shifts, evolves to have more the characteristics of those better performing individuals than of the, let's call them, the weaker individuals. Well, that's what's gone on with the ice fish. That's what's gone on with us. That's what's gone on with every species, is that these sets of genetic mistakes made in every generation, and all sorts of sets of them get made in the course of time, that there's a competition going on and sort of a winnowing and sifting of those mistakes and those combinations of genes that work better. And for the ice fish, it was those mutations that actually reduced its red blood cells count, first probably in increments and then to absolutely zero, those same mutations would be absolutely fatal in every other vertebrate on the planet. So we have to understand that the fittest is a very conditional thing. It really depends on the exact circumstances and the moment in time that these individuals are living. The ice fish has accumulated things that wouldn't work for other species. In fact, they'd be disastrous. And at the same time, take the ice fish out of that environment that it's in, and it would do very poorly. It would certainly do very poorly in competition with other species. These fish, and I happen to be lucky enough to have seen them, in an aquarium in Genoa, Italy, of all places. But the Italians have an Antarctic science program, and they went to great efforts to bring these fish back to their aquarium. I happened to be there in November and lucky enough to see the fish. They are about the most inactive animals I've ever observed.
Well, they're anemic, right?
They're essentially anemic. So they are predators. They have very large jaws, and they eat live prey. But they do that in very short bursts, and they cannot withstand long periods of activity. So they would do very poorly in warmer waters with lots of fast-moving fish around.
They'd be metabolism, gone. Too. Then they're like they're sort of hibernating on the fin.
That's right. And in fact, if you warm them up a few degrees in the laboratory or in a fish tank, they're in real trouble. They're in actually great distress. Because the other thing about warmer water is it has less oxygen, and they're dependent upon cold, cold water to deliver enough oxygen to their tissues. So they're fine-tuned, as most species are, to be fit, or the best competitors in certain niches, but not in others.
You talk about how sometimes one progression from a genetic point of view, like resisting malaria, can lead to a problem with another, like sickle cell anemia. We'll talk about that and other evolutionary questions when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Listen to many WPR programs at your convenience when you visit WPR.org. Browse the archive of current and past programs. WPR.org is there to give you options.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Sean Carroll. And we're discussing DNA and the ultimate forensic record of evolution. This wonderful ice fish that we have that's made this adaptation to hyper-cold water seems to have been so successful, but literally a fish out of water if you warm up the environment. How does that apply in human terms? Have there been changes that would work in one place but not in another?
Absolutely. The most dramatic example I can think of in human case has to do with our battle with malaria over recent millennia. We think, particularly with the advent of agriculture, as society started to settle near sources of water, that we started to enter this tremendous struggle with the parasite malaria, which is carried about by mosquitoes. And in Africa, there's a very high incidence of a mutation in one of the genes for our globins. The same genes, essentially the same counterparts of the genes we're talking about in the ice fish. And this mutation, clearly, when it's present in one copy, conveys some benefit to people that carry it in terms of reducing their body burden with the malarial parasite and increasing essentially their health, their overall health. So they're more resistant to malaria. This mutation, when present in two copies, and we have two copies of most all genes in our genome, causes the full-blown disease, sickle cell anemia. So this is a case where a mutation is beneficial to a certain degree, but there's a trade-off there because two copies of the mutation carry with it a very large penalty. And outside of malarial zones, of course, there's no benefit to this mutation whatsoever, and there's a health burden associated with it. So what that illustrates, and if we were to look at a map of where there's a high incidence of the sickle cell mutation, it's virtually superimposable upon areas of high incidence of malaria. And what's gone on in recent human history is this struggle against malaria has meant that malarial parasite has been a form of natural selection on human populations. And those humans carrying this mutation have survived longer, produced more offspring than those without it. And so that's why we see such a tremendous signature of natural selection in populations in malarial zones, and that they have this mutation that's virtually unheard of outside of those zones. Now, that's, of course, with humans migrating around the globe, of course, the mutation does exist in other populations. But really, if you look at indigenous people, that this is a very striking signature. I think that what's important to take home from that is that evolution works by any means necessary, not necessarily, well, not, I would say, the most desirable means if we could engineer such things. This is a mutation that causes some collateral health risk. So there are trade-offs. Just as the ice fish is trading to live in its environment, it's trading off a red-blooded lifestyle. We're trading off some of our health, or people in malarial zones are trading off some of their health because malarial is a bigger enemy than sickle cell.
It's a kind of a vulnerability swap, I guess, is what
That's
it is.
Right.
Wouldn't another example then be the way we've sort of evolved to resist famine, but that makes it hard in terms of obesity and diabetes?
That's right. Our constitution these days is really something that's been inherited from our ancestors who did not have ready access to processed foods and things like that, and enormous amounts of corn syrup and light beer. And so a lot of our health problems these days come to the fact that our genetics and physiology are not tuned to our available diet. And we can see this in all sorts of people across the world, that when they come in contact with a diet that's not been the typical diet of their ancestors, that various health problems ensue, and obesity and diabetes being the most obvious ones.
Can you give some more examples? Because I just love reading about them in your book, besides the transparent ice fish, some of the other eccentric, really bizarre creatures in natural history that prove some of your ideas about evolution.
Well, I guess there's a whole zoo full of favorite creatures in this book. Cave fish, for example, or other sorts of cave animals. One of the very common observations of cave animals is that they have lost their vision and often their body pigmentation. Now, let's think about that for a little while. Again, think about it a bit in the context of the ice fish or these other examples I'm giving you. If a species is now living in the dark, visual communication becomes insignificant, and body coloration is, of course, not significant either, because you're neither advertising to fellow members of the same species nor necessarily involved in evading predators or anything like that. And what happens is that shift in lifestyle means that the pressures of the surface world outside the cave have really changed. No longer living in light, no longer visible to predators in the same way, no longer visible to other members of the same species, the conditions of natural selection have shifted. What happens? Well, for example, the loss of pigment. Well, I explain in one of the chapters in the book that if we go look at one of these populations and look at their pigment genes, there are mutations in these pigment genes that have inactivated the genes. And this is a case, sort of a simple lesson of use it or lose it. This is going on in evolution all the time. Shifting lifestyles mean that certain genes that were used in a particular lifestyle become unnecessary in another lifestyle. And we see that what happens is mutations that would normally occur, but they would not succeed in those populations. So if you're a surface-dwelling fish and you lose all your pigment or you lose your vision, you're at a tremendous handicap, but not in a cave. So living in a cave, mutations that accumulate in these genes really carry no penalty with them whatsoever. And so you have most cave-dwelling animals lacking pigment and lacking vision because there's no condition to insist, no natural selection to preserve body pigment or vision. So peculiar creatures, again, cave animals teach us this general lesson about natural selection, that sort of use it or lose it.
That's kind of an extension, it seems to me, of what we were talking about with the ice fish, where the ice fish is actually adapting specific positives to that environment, whereas here you're saying, well, if it doesn't just do you any good or any bad, you're going to lose it.
That's right. And what natural selection does, and there's really two sides, you might even say almost three sides to natural selection. I don't know if that's a good description, but let's talk about two sides to natural selection. Most people think about the what we call sort of the creative side of natural selection, adapting to some new environment and inventing new tricks to go about that. And the book is full of examples like that. But there is a flip side to natural selection, which is its preservative side. That is, since mutations occur all the time, if there was no process of preserving the text of DNA and preserving certain functions, all that information would decay. What natural selection does, and this, again, this competitive process, is that when mutations occur that would be injurious, those mutations do not get passed on. They're not successful in spreading in numbers through a population because they're less competitive. And so what we mean by natural selection is two things. We mean favoring advantageous changes and rejecting injurious changes. Those are virtually Darwin's exact words. And that rejection of injurious change means that a lot of things stay the same over long periods of time. In the case of the cavefish, those changes which would be injurious to other fish are neutral. They really have no consequences to that fish. Natural selection is itself blind to them. They don't increase or decrease performance of those fish whatsoever. And so those mutations accumulate and the fish and other cave animals lose their pigment, lose their vision.
You talk about how, although there's this tremendous variety, you also have repetition. You also have sort of the same mutation, adaptation, selection taking place in different regions.
That's right. Let's go back to, for example, the malarial example. We can tell from human pedigrees that that sickle cell mutation has arisen at least 5 times in Africa and the Indian subcontinent in different indigenous groups and spread throughout those regions. So that tells you a little bit something about when mutations, they arise at random, but they don't spread at random. They spread under this process of natural selection. And natural selection will select for the same adaptations again and again and again. I mentioned the ice fish of the Southern Ocean and their antifreeze. Well, 10 million years apart at the opposite pole, Arctic fish invented an antifreeze that looks a heck of a lot like the ice fish antifreeze. Heck of a lot at one level, but when we look a little deeper at the DNA code, it's clear that it's an independent invention. So 10 million years apart at opposite ends of the pole, fish came up with antifreeze.
An even more often cited example of that kind of thing would be you have bats with wings, you have insects with wings, and you have
pterosaurs with wings, birds with wings.
Right, all kinds of
That's
things
right.
with wings,
That's right.
So, which obviously came from
right.
different times,
so there,
different places.
If you look in detail, pterosaur wings, bird wings, bat wings, they all are modifications of the vertebrate forelimb, what we would call our arms and hands. If you look in detail, the changes to the skeleton of the forelimb are different in each of those cases. So they all became wings. So in a general sense, they're very similar to each other. In detail, they're a bit different. Insect wings are an altogether different invention. But nonetheless, flight has involved the modification, this sort of creation of the, or evolution, I should say, of these airfoils that are out towards the front of the animal. So similar aeronautic demands have been met with similar sorts of adaptations. So sometimes these events are not repeated in exquisite detail. Sometimes they are. When I talk about the sickle cell mutation, I'm talking about the exact same letter of DNA code changing to the exact same letter of the DNA code 5 times in the recent course of human history.
There's something particularly intriguing about that, isn't there, though, that particular thing? I mean, are we talking about, well, a fairly narrow span of history if we're talking about humans, for
That's
one
right.
thing. And we're talking about a very specific gene among a lot of genes.
That's right.
And if we're talking about error and trial, as you put it, that's either a lot of error and trial or there's something going on there.
I try to help you out a little bit. In one of the chapters here, I talk about this repetition of evolution and go over the numbers. Now, the arithmetic isn't that daunting. We're not going to be able to do it on the air. But if you think about if you think about the number of individuals and you think about the frequency of mutation, it's quite clear that the same mutations come up all the time. Now, whether you're talking about the human population or a population of mice living in the desert or a population of insects living in your backyard, some of those species obviously produce such enormous amounts of offspring that the same mutations are pretty easy to picture. But if you start running the math and you think about, oh, let's think of seagulls that, you know, a certain species of seagulls that might have 10 million offspring born in a particular year. Some of those gulls within the course of a decade or a few decades will have the exact same mutations appear more than once. You can crunch the same sorts of numbers with humans. And when those mutations arise, if they cause a very significant difference in performance, the rapidity with which an advantage spreads through a population is proportional to the magnitude of the advantage it provides. So natural selection can be very swift on very large differences. So coloration differences, for example, in animals, those that might either hinder or enhance camouflage from predators, natural selection is very powerful in those circumstances and species can evolve or change their coloration in a matter of a few decades.
So if you have a volcano that goes off, suddenly the landscape goes from green to gray, and suddenly you have, instead of green moths, you have gray moths.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And that's right. And that can occur very, very quickly.
You talk about the predator-prey relationship as one where there's adaptation happening on both sides. And I think the graphic example you give came with the death of someone from swallowing a toxic newt. Can you elaborate on that?
And this is my nominee for the Darwin Award. It's a true story.
Or the Macbeth Award. I'm not sure which.
It's a true story, so we have to be a little bit sensitive here. But I guess on a drinking dare, a gentleman, this is in the early 1980s, swallowed an animal in Oregon called the rough-skinned newt, probably not knowing that the rough-skinned newt is one of the most toxic vertebrates that you could ever ingest. And the reason is that these newts are in an arms race with garter snakes in the area. They're the favorite prey of some garter snakes. And these newts have a toxin called tetrodotoxin. It's the same toxin that's in pufferfish, and it's used in Haitian voodoo. But this toxin can incapacitate the garter snake, actually kill it. But the garter snakes have evolving resistance. So what happens is this. More resistant newts survive, because if they can essentially kill their predator, they're often disgorged by the snake upon death and they can crawl back out. But then, of course, more resistant snakes survive better. So what goes on over time is you get increasingly toxic newts and increasingly resistant snakes. And so as this has played out over a while, the newts become preposterously toxic, so toxic that they can take down a 180-pound man, which is, you know, way outside the ballpark of just a little 3-foot garter snake. And so it's a great illustration of how these kind of arms races can put evolution in a fast-forward mode. So these snakes are incredibly resistant on average to this toxin, but the newts are still getting more toxic because of this process of natural selection. Those newts that are a little bit more toxic have a little better chance of survival if they encounter a garter snake, and their offspring have a better chance of survival. So this race has been going on the Oregon coast for I don't know how long. But now you have these newts that are so dangerous that you shouldn't swallow them, no matter what the beer payoff.
I sometimes wonder why everybody isn't just toxic.
Maybe we are.
Well, you know, these arms races are going on in our bodies all the time. I mean, it's the game we play against viruses. Viruses have a very short replication cycle, and they usually have very high mutation rates. This is absolutely true of the AIDS virus. This is why the AIDS virus has been so great a challenge to develop a vaccine against it, is the very high mutation rate of the virus. Our immune systems are trying to keep up with this in terms of warding off infections or neutralizing viruses. And it's a race. And what we try to do in medicine, of course, is engineer, sort of anticipate and stay ahead of a virus or stay ahead of a bacterium. But in the natural world, these sorts of interactions of arms races between predator and prey or host and parasite are going on all the time. It's that arms race with the malarial parasite that's had such a huge impact on our genetic evolution. There's all sorts of other genes that affect our red blood cell physiology that have also been affected by this battle with malaria, for example.
Well, another one of the beasts that fascinates me are actually, I guess it's more than one, are those that can live outside the mouths of active volcanoes, both underwater and above. How could you possibly develop in a way that would make that possible?
These are so-called thermophilic creatures. They're the kinds that are in hot springs. They're by the smoke vents that we know lie along fault lines in the ocean. They also, some of their relatives live in incredibly high salt environments in various lakes. They can also live in extremely acidic environments. Some of those smoky sulfur cauldrons in Yellow Springs are not only really hot, but they're also incredibly acidic. And these microbes can live there. And we think, a lot of biologists think, this is a pretty good proxy for the sort of life that was around at the beginning of cellular life on the planet. Now, the planet was warmer than it was now. There were all sorts of pockets, of course, of a lot of geothermal activity. Those pockets tend to be very rich in all sorts of minerals and other things. We sort of think that it's part of the broth that sort of that early life had to live off of, sort of, again, a double-edged sword. It was these were hot places to live, but at the same time, they were rich in a lot of the materials that life needs to sustain itself. So these organisms have developed, their physiology actually runs better at very high temperatures. You drop them down to the temperatures that our bodies run at best, and these cells are dead. So life's adaptability, whether it's to the sub-freezing water or to above the temperature of boiling water at essentially the pH of very strong acid, all that is the range of life on Earth.
Maybe Mars, too.
Maybe Mars. That's perhaps a different program. But I just talked to a geophysicist working on the origin of life, and I think I have the number right, that their operating number now is that they think they're somewhere in the universe, there's somewhere around 100 million billion Earth-like planets. So they feel the odds, if it's not on Mars, the odds of life elsewhere are really good.
Doing a show just like this one as we speak.
With all this evidence, you'd think there'd be no controversy about evolution, but of course that's not the case, and we're going to confront the controversy when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
Information on upcoming programs, listener feedback, and staff bios are among the features found in WPR's monthly e-newsletter, Radio Waves. To receive this free monthly update on all things WPR, sign up today at WPR.org.
This textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered. That is an evolution disclaimer on Cobb County, Georgia textbooks that was printed in 2002, but the stickers ordered removed by federal judge Clarence Cooper in January of 2005. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Sean Carroll, and we're talking about evolution. He's the author of the recent The Making of the Fittest, DNA and the Ultimate Forensic Record of Evolution. And we'll also have a link to his website on our University of the Air website on public radio. Well, let me ask you, Sean, in terms of this controversy that is still here with us with evolution, intelligent design, and all the rest of it, do you think that a lot of it has to do with how hard it is for human beings to grasp what they're being told about how similar they might be to a fruit fly or to a worm?
It's either probably a combination of how hard it is to grasp and how resistant they are to grasping that. I think that for some people, they find that sort of demeaning and undermining sort of their sense of humans as something above the rest of the animal kingdom. And I think that's the opposition that evolution has faced since the formulation of its key ideas 150 years ago. So if it was just a matter of teaching the science, then we would only have the challenge of teaching the science better. And we're so much better equipped to do that in the last couple of decades than we were ever before. We've got a richer fossil record. We have this rich DNA record. We have all sorts of very, very clear examples of how DNA works at the ultimate level. So we should be in great shape. But I think culturally it's a bit more complex than that.
Well, how do you go about then opening the conversation with people who would say evolution is just one of many approaches? It should be taught as a theory, not as something definitive.
Well, theory in science means something much different than theory means in sort of everyday conversation. You know, you'll hear somebody say, oh, that's my theory and I'm sticking to it. That sort of means that's my conjecture, my speculation, sort of my favorite idea of the day. Theory in science is established by testing and repeated testing and the consistency of observations from different arenas. And it's both an assemblage of facts and tested hypotheses and really reaching the level of sort of cementing by its ability to support that incredibly rigorous scrutiny or to withstand that incredibly rigorous scrutiny. So when we talk about the theory of evolution, we talk about an extremely large body of knowledge that none of us can imagine being overturned.
But why isn't it called a law the way Newton or, you know, some
or
of the other...
Or a proof. Well, I think that...
What has to happen before it would move out of the realm of theory then?
Well, I mean, remember, even laws have circumstances under which they may or may not apply. And I think that theory has a long, long, long history of the use of the term. And that's meant to be embodying a whole lot of types of things. And it even can include certain sorts of laws. So there is just the use of theory in the vernacular that we have to be a little bit concerned about. But nonetheless, I don't think this is all a battle about semantics. I think semantics are sort of a device, or debating semantics is a device to sort of distract people away from the heart of the matter, which is the overwhelming evidence in support of evolution and the overwhelming opposition to evolution for people that have other interests and feel that those interests are threatened by evolutionary science. in one chapter in the book called Seeing and Believing, sort of the late part of the book, I talk about a lot of devices that have been used over the years to challenge scientific knowledge. And not just by, for example, religiously motivated groups, but in other circles as well. I talk about how doctors opposed Pasteur's germ theory, or how the science of genetics and even DNA as the hereditary material was opposed in the Soviet Union for over 30 years by, in fact, people calling themselves scientists, or how currently and historically chiropractors have opposed the science of vaccination. So there's all sorts of tactics that are used by groups that are seeking to advance a different perspective and to challenge the authority of science. And that involves all sorts of tactics of first denying the science in various ways, emphasizing particular risks, sort of holding up gadflies as authorities, sort of appealing to personal freedom. You know, why do my children have to be taught evolution? You know, I'm an American and I have the right to have my children taught something else, this sort of thing. But those, once you sort of peel back those tactics, you understand that they're really driven by a concern out of protecting some particular ideology or self-interest on the parts of those groups. And I'm happy to say that when evolution has been challenged in the courtroom, that at least for many decades in the United States, it's done very well at the federal court level. You may be aware the intelligent design movement faced a severe test that was ruled upon just a year ago, and the teaching of intelligent design was deemed unconstitutional.
Was that in Dover?
That was in Dover. That was in the Kitzmiller versus Dover school board case.
And it was unconstitutional because it was considered religion?
That's right. And the key words of the judge was that this was just the, quote, progeny of creation science, another earlier attempt to portray creation myths as science. And what the scientific community and the educational community is concerned about is that when you talk about alternative explanations, well, in scientific terms, there are no alternative explanations to evolutionary science. There are alternative explanations for life on Earth or the diversity of life on Earth, but those are not scientific ones. And you certainly have a constitutional right to teach those in the home or in a church-affiliated school or in any other sort of environment but the public schools. The domain of the public schools falls under the domain of the U.S. Constitution. And so the battle, if you like, has been really for what is proper to teach in public schools. And the scientific community has fought very hard that it's what science is what gets taught in public schools. And I might add that the clergy have been important allies in all this. Clergy certainly representing certain denominations, that many denominations do not want to see religious ideas taught in the public schools. They feel that's their job in the home and in church-affiliated schools or church-affiliated programs or on Friday night or Saturday or Sunday or whatever the practice might be of the church. And so these battle lines are about what's taught in public schools. There is in the United States the constitutional right to teach your children anything you want outside of that domain.
You move beyond the controversy in your final chapter to talk about why it matters, sort of for the future, that we understand evolution.
Well, we rely upon the natural world for so many resources vital to human civilization, whether that's our food, our land, our streams, things like this. And the decay of either ecosystems or the intense pressure placed on particular species has great impacts on our economic vitality and on our access to certain food sources and things like this. And so in that last chapter, I talk about the pressures that various populations are under or have been under and succumbed to. For example, intense fishing. The fishing of the world oceans has become much more intense and sophisticated since World War II, and the consequences of that are dramatic declines in large fish, whether that's tuna, marlin, et cetera, or just fish that are caught up in this process, such as sharks and skates and things like this. And that's turning our oceans ecosystems upside down. It's also depleting, you know, very large animals from the waters at rates that look like far exceed what can be sustained. We know that from the collapse of various fisheries that have happened in recent years. The signature of those pressures on those populations are there in terms of rapidly evolving fish populations. Dragging a net across the ocean bottom is a very strong form of selection. It says that if you're a certain size, you might get through, but if you're another size, you get caught up. And so there's tremendous pressure on body size in fish, on the age at reproduction, things like this. We're having a big impact on the biology of a lot of populations around the world. So a practical understanding of selection and populations and reproduction and genetics is vital to just managing our natural resources. It's just a really practical matter of our own self-interest that we understand how evolution works, because we're a big agent in it right now.
A friend of mine who had some experience with the DNR said that we're selecting for smarter deer by shooting all the ones who don't see the hunter coming. You almost wonder if there's not some truth in that.
I imagine there could be some element of truth in that. But we do, I give an example even in the book of the hunting of bighorn, which was under a very managed program. But it turned out that without the right amount of biological information, the age at which these sheep reproduce and habits of the males and things like this, that accidentally there was tremendous selection against the more robust male specimens of bighorn, and that was really weakening the overall population. And these were populations that are under conservation programs and under lots of observation. So we do need to understand a lot more biology, and we need to understand what the compounded effects are of our activity, what they have on these populations. And I just want to emphasize that that's just no philosophical point. That's just a pragmatic matter of if those populations are going to be there 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now for everyone else to enjoy and to exploit, we've got to be smarter about it.
And if our population is going to be here, for that matter. Sean Carroll has been with us. Thanks for joining us. It's been a fascinating hour. We could have easily gone more, and maybe we will before too long. Hope so.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for our next hour of University of the Air.